This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. I'm glad you've tuned in. By the way, you can jump in on social media. We're on Twitter, live tweeting the show at KUOW. Now, if you will, imagine a stadium built by the patriarchy. Go with me here, okay? Katie and Roni?
Okay. So
with
good.
You, 100%.
So there.
Some people are fine with the stadium. They're playing along. Others are trying to tear it down. Others have excused themselves from the arena and just started to build their own thing. Mm-hmm. I've got two stadium defectors with me now. Katie Anthony and Ronit Fineglass-Plank, they co-host the podcast Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory. You also have a new show on the Young Turks Network called Smart Mouth. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
In your case, Katie, welcome back. Good to see you again. And Ronit, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. So happy to be here.
I enjoy your podcast.
So glad.
Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory. So, Katie, let's start with this. You've said that this stadium idea, you know, the stadium that exists and the one we could build on our own. You said that the films Wonder Woman and Justice League are examples of this what exists versus do it yourself.
How's totally. That? So in a conversation about how women are changing the media landscape right now, one of the most important questions that we can ask ourselves is, are we still reacting to rules that have been put into place for decades, centuries, that are kind of part of our social cultural fabric? Or are we creating a new conversation? And one of my favorite examples of this is the contrast between the Amazon costumes in Wonder Woman versus the Amazon costumes in Justice League.
For those who haven't seen it, by Amazon, we're discussing not next day delivery, but the warriors in Wonder Woman. Yes, go on, please.
Exactly. So in Wonder Woman was helmed by a female director and the costumes were designed by a female costume designer. And those costumes that the Amazons wore, this is a race of woman warriors. And these costumes were first and foremost armor. They were functional pieces of equipment that these women needed to do their work. Did they also look smoking hot? Of course they did. But that was a...
high boots.
Totally. Well, let's discuss the high boots.
Okay.
Because the high boot has become
I've seen this in the movie, yes.
Yeah. The high boot has become a very sexualized kind of piece of wardrobe of a woman's kind of seduction arsenal, so to speak. But in this movie, you could see that these high boots also had a function, which was that for these Amazon women riding horseback, they needed to be able to protect their shins and knees from blows from an attacker. And so as you're watching this movie as a viewer, as a woman viewer, I remember looking at these women and thinking, yes, they're beautiful. But more importantly, their costumes were designed knowing that they had so much more to offer than just their pleasing appearance. And these costumes are here to serve them in their work and in their kind of identity as warriors.
In battle.
Exactly, okay. In battle. Now, look at Justice League's costume.
I have not seen Justice League. You'll have to help me out.
Me neither. But I looked at all the costumes online.
Okay.
I didn't see it. I heard it was terrible. I'm sorry. But the costumes in Justice League, the women's torsos are exposed. Their midriffs are exposed. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm going into battle, I want my organs covered, right? Like, I don't want my kidneys hanging out there. I want to make sure that I have, like, I'm covered and I'm protected going into battle. And you could just see really clearly, you know, the boots didn't have the armor on them. They were just sexy boots. Mm. And there's nothing wrong with a woman wearing sexy boots. But in the case of these two movies side by side, you can really see the difference between having women at the helm where their sole priority is to make sure that these characters can function, and having men at the helm where their sole priority is to make sure that these characters are pleasing. And in Wonder Woman, you can really see these women changing the conversation and, in essence, playing the game in their own stadium.
Well, that has to do with the objectification, because, you know, not to overemphasize this, but the male gaze is in Justice League is more prevalent, right? So when you have Patty Jenkins' movie, the new Wonder Woman with Gal Gadot, that the functionality is there because they're in action, they're moving, they have a purpose in life other than to be watched, other than to be sensual. They are doing something, and if you find them attractive, if you find them sensual, that's great, but that's not the primary objective. They have lives, and the lens on them is one of respect, I think, and well-roundedness.
So the sexy boots and the exposed midriffs, that's not just selling to young women who've been marketed to and their parents have been marketed to and the whole patriarchal system, but it's also the male gaze. You think that's the idea is pandering to what men want to see?
Well, think about it. Even if you think about comics, you know, cartoons for kids, okay? And I was talking a little bit before about, I was thinking about the cartoons that kids grow up with and the different roles for women and for men on the cartoons. And a lot of times you'll see in movies, you don't see a man lounging very much or stretching languorously. If it's a superhero, you don't find these moments of repose where they're sort of coyly looking at the camera and beckoning you, right? Mm-hmm. There's not a come hither thing going on. They're momentum and action. And so think about if you dress those male characters that way, the way that women have traditionally been dressed in these superhero movies, it's absurd. You'd say, what's the point of that? That's complete eye candy. There's nothing else going on. And so I really appreciate it when women are given equal treatment and also looked at from a gaze of respect and personhood.
And let me ask you now about your own personal stadium building then. So have you had to work to unlearn, to change your gaze, to change what gaze you care about?
Oh my gosh, so much.
Okay.
Yes.
Tell me, please.
So an example from a show that we just shot for Smart Mouth that's going to be dropping tomorrow. We wanted to do a segment on this new movie that's being filmed in Louisiana right now called Roe versus Wade. And it is a pro-life
extravaganza.
Yeah, it is a pro-life extravaganza.
Pro-life-a-palooza.
I believe we called it a barf bag experience on our TV show. We have a strong opinion about it, but there have been a lot of think pieces about it because the script has been widely leaked. It's extremely inaccurate.
Production people are dropping like flies when places for filming find out what the project actually is, because it's under the pseudonym 1973 right now. But when they find out that it's a Roe versus Wade, very slanted toward pro-life and unequal treatment movie of the situation, they bail. They kick them out of shooting.
So this is not a political objection you're making. This is a sort of just bad portrayal of the world.
Exactly.
Objection.
But as we were planning this segment, we were trying to have a conversation as we're developing the content, like, what do we actually want to say about this movie? Mm-hmm. And is there anything that we can say about this movie that's not going to be reactive and that's not going to be beginning within the premise that Nick Loeb, the producer of this movie, should have a right to say what I can do or not do with my body? No matter how we engage with that content, we're going to his stadium that he built, we're playing by his rules, and even if we ostensibly win this game, all we've done is prove what a great game you built.
Yeah, we basically fall for the ploy, right? We take the bait, and then we're talking about his movie and helping to advertise it.
Exactly. And so, you know, we kind of settled on the idea that, okay, they purchased their platform, they rented their cameras, they wrote their script, they hired their cast, they hired their crew, the crew all left, they hired a brand new crew. Mm-hmm. And they bought their platform, but they didn't buy our platform. So instead of digging into all of the ways that this film is awful, we're going to let it do bad all by itself. And we dedicated our segment to spreading more information about why women's reproductive freedom is important. We also highlighted a really incredible organization called Womentum that's like a Kiva giving group. And the really cool thing about Womentum is that they do micro-lending to women in developing nations. But rather than asking those women to then pay back those loans, they ask them to pay them forward. And then they teach these women to like create communities of women entrepreneurs in their hometowns.
So you see what Katie just did? Katie, you brought us all over to your new stadium, and I'm sitting and I have a really good seat, and I think Bill's here too. I think that what you did was take a question about something that we were interested in, and we turned it into something that we're interested in, which is women in media, and it's our gaze. And part of what we did was we also talked on that show, which is airing tomorrow night, about the communications director for Planned Parenthood spoke to Jezebel, that online news source, and basically made a statement about abortion. And this is about reproductive rights. And it's not about life or death as much as it is about saving women and giving them reproductive freedom. And he talked about how the large percentage of Americans want people to have the right to abortion, even if they're Republicans or conservatives. So it was a great platform for us to say what we wanted to say without going low.
Even though we wanted to.
Yeah.
Katie Anthony and Ronit Fineglass-Plank. The podcast is Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory, and they have a new show on the Young Turks Network. It's called Smart Mouth. And you talked about women in media. I remember I thought it was a useful idea when I was in college or so, people started talking about the Bechdel test, way of looking at women in media. Will you describe what that is, Katie, and how well you think that idea has aged?
Yeah, so the Bechdel test is a test of movies where in order to pass the Bechdel test, there have to be two female characters in the movie, preferably named. They have to talk to each other about something other than men. And so if...
Wait, do women do that?
No, never.
Wait, ever talk about things other than men?
Well, we talk about our hair.
So that we can look good.
And shoes.
Men? Yeah.
For men. Yeah, totally.
Okay. No. Go on. Sorry.
But no, seriously. Mm-hmm. If Ronit and I had this conversation, Ronit, it's really hot outside today.
Yeah, it's really hot, Katie.
It wouldn't matter if we were like in gold bikinis chained to a statue of Donald Trump. That would
pass the test.
We passed the Bechdel test, right? And so one really, really interesting example that I didn't know passed the Bechdel test is the movie The Disaster Artist. Just from this last year, this is a movie This is a movie about Tommy Wiseau, who was reportedly very abusive on the set of his film *The Room*. The Disaster Artist is about the filming of *The Room*, and it was made by James Franco, who has now been accused of inappropriate sexual contact by five women, four of whom were his students. But because two women on screen in this movie have a conversation about the script that they're about to perform, the script, by the way, written by Tommy Wiseau, it passes the Bechdel test. And it has somehow found its way into some kind of stamp of approval or half approval by being an inclusive work of art or
Well, what's the mouthy, messy, mandatory test?
I know. I was just going to say, you know, I needed a primer, a refresher on the Bechdel test because my jaw is like dropped. Is that really? That's all it takes?
That's
they
the
need
bar.
To revisit the Bechdel test. Let's call it. Yeah. What's the mouthy, messy, mandatory test? Let's do that.
Girl, I mean, I think it's got to be at least as many named women as men in the story.
That's right.
The women have to have interests.
They have to have lives independent of the men.
Yeah.
Arcs. We like arcs.
I love a good arc.
I like an arc for myself in real life, and I also like it in my media.
Yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. Yes. I would love to see also inclusion, you know, behind the camera, so to speak. I'd love to see, you know, a minimum number of you know, like the inclusion writers that Frances McDormand talked about in her Oscar acceptance speech, you know, minimum number of female crew members, female writers.
Yeah, and when you look at production companies these days, I did a quick look on women run production companies right now, and I just did a smattering of them. And of course, there's Shonda Rhimes, there's Hello Sunshine with Reese Witherspoon, there's Brownstone, which is Eva Longoria, Simpson, which is Kerry Washington, Lucky Chap, Margot Robbie, and Margot Robbie did the Tanya movie. So,
hi, Tanya.
Even when you have a woman at the helm in any kind of capacity, I would like to think that the gaze is a little bit shifted and maybe more even-handed.
I actually have an example of this that's outside of the realm of media, which I think kind of helped me understand a little bit more what we're looking for in media. I have a friend who plays softball, and she has a shoulder injury, and she went to doctor after doctor after doctor after physical therapist, and they kept prescribing the same treatments that weren't working, and her shoulder pain was not getting any better. And she went to a new physical therapist, the first woman that she had seen. And her physical therapist said, I think your bra strap might be exacerbating the condition. And she changed from an over-the-shoulder bra strap to a racer back bra strap, and her shoulder pain was better within a week.
So interesting.
So how can we, and that is something that you would not necessarily expect a male practitioner to think about, because even if he can see like, oh, well, her bra strap crosses there, he's never had the experience of the discomfort necessarily of wearing
well, her lived like experience. And of course, this is a pretty great story with a very clear example and a very happy ending. That's a very clear cut and awesome diagnosis. But it's really a good example of thinking outside of the box or outside of one's own kind of confines.
In the public radio world, how important did you think it was that now The Takeaway has, which was hosted by John Hockenberry, he left last year, and then after that we found out about
the allegations, right?
Yes.
Well, it's interesting because Tenzina, I remember when Tenzina Vega took over, I had listened to the show before and I liked it. I always listen in the morning for drop off kids and stuff like that. And people were welcoming her. Guests that came on her show, they would kind of just congratulate her on her new position. And they seemed genuinely happy for her, which I thought was lovely. And I've been listening to her. And this morning, in fact, she was covering Puerto Rico's conquering of Puerto Rico, which I never, ever would have even thought of. And I don't know if John Hockenberry would have brought that to the table. Mm. And I was thinking about how I sort of have an implicit level of trust that she's going to guide me toward the stories that I'm going to be interested in and other people are going to be interested in, with a level of empathy and open-mindedness that I can rely on early on. That's how I feel about her.
Do you ever wonder whether your trust in someone is based at the right level on their relatability to you, their representation, their identity?
I do think so. You know, it may not be the best or most polite answer, but I think that we are human beings, we're animals, and we do feel comfortable around things we know and people we know, right? We're not that different from other animals. And unfortunately, it is the case that if I see a woman on a street late at night, I'm going to feel more comfortable than if I see a man. If I'm talking to someone who understands where I grew up, for example, and they grew up in a similar situation in an apartment, let's say with like a ton of roaches, and they grew up there too. I mean, I might have grown up like that. You know, I'm just saying, like, then I'm going to say, you understand my experience. You know what I'm talking about. And you're not as much looking at the situation from outside. So it's just sort of like a natural response, I think. What about you, Katie?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, you know, there's a natural defensiveness that comes up when you're relating to someone who is in some ways not like you. Because when they ask about the divergence of the types of people you are, you have to wait and see, like, are you asking to see if I'll confirm who you think I am? Or are you trying to get to know me as an individual? And the more you have in common with another person, the easier it is to say, I believe that you're going to see me as an individual.
Am I hopelessly limited? Please be honest
here. Oh, I was going to ask you, how do you feel about being a white man at the helm of the show? These days.
Well, I'm doing my best, and believe me, well, I don't know if I'm ever doing my best, but I'm trying. But internally, as my producers can tell you, you talk to these producers. I asked that question. You know, there's a lot of interviews done by a middle-aged white, you know, cisgender, straight, able. I am who I am, and. I wonder, we only have a minute and a half left, so I want to hear from you.
Do you have to work harder to make sure people can trust you or earn your position
these
days? Yes,
but I don't mind having to work harder. I think I do. And I'm also curious if you think that, because I'm looking to you, who do you feel like I'm hopelessly limited as a host?
In some ways, I'm going to disagree with you, Ronit. I'm going to say yes.
Let's go.
In some ways, yes, because you don't have the lived experience of anybody else. And so many of those stories are really emerging onto the forefront as being really necessarily told. But because you have a platform that you are able to share with those people and amplify their message, you also are empowered to really be a game changer, because you can also interpret those stories in a voice and with a face that other people can see as like a valid messenger.
And also, I think you have something really important, which is curiosity. And I think curiosity is one of the most important ingredients to understanding other people and opening empathy. So I think that alone gets you so far ahead of people who are not going to listen or be open.
Well, until they replace me, which might be a good idea, thank you for doing your podcast and thank you for coming on my show.
It was such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Ronit Fineglass-Plank and Katie Anthony co-host a podcast together, Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory. They have a new show on the Young Turks Network. It's called Smart Mouth. Come see us again. Thank you.